So our second half is going to sort of be fit into two halves. The first half is Matthew Hollis is going to be reading to us from some of his own work, and then he's going to be sort of chairing and leading a discussion with all of the poets sort of ranged in front of us amongst themselves, but also hopefully with you in the audience. Any questions you might have about the world of poetry, how to enter it, what makes a great collection, any questions that might have occurred to you through the time you've been sitting here or through the years you've been waiting to come to this very event. So please, warm hand of welcome for Matthew Hollis.
Thank you very much, Martin. And the second half, as Martin was saying, is I'm going to read for about 6 or 8 minutes, and then the four poets will also read one poem. And as they read one poem, you'll see them kind of gracefully join me behind the microphone. And I'm also very thrilled to say that that we are going to have, within the question and answer, David Wheatley is going to join us. David, who is a fine poet and editor of Beckett, and also of Mito magazine, is going to come and join us for the conversation Q&A. So that's the shape of the second half, and then we'll finish with the poem. One of the things that, what do poets talk about when they're on a bus tour? Is it Larkin? Actually, it seems to be typography. As far as I can work out, most of the conversations that have been going around, both in the audience and among many of us, is this fascination that poets have with the way in poems are laid out on the page, the details of kerns and leading and particular fount that's used. We began the tour in Norwich, which is my hometown, and we actually stayed in my house. And that house was a place that I also looked after my father when he was ill, and I spent a year there, coming from university to come home and care for him. And after the illness, which he didn't survive, I found myself not going back into academia, but applying for a job at the Oxford University Press. I had no rights to apply for. I mean, I'd founded a small press at university and published a little magazine called Ibid, where we used to just publish ourselves under different names because we couldn't get submissions. And in fact, actually, that reminds me, I was so shy-minded at the time that I even came up with the pseudonym García Lorca, not knowing that there was such a poet at the time. And so this small Scottish magazine called Ibid had a new undiscovered poem by García Lorca, and I didn't understand the fuss at the time. I was just pleased people were interested in my poem. But anyway, I did go to work at the Oxford University Press, and why I tell you all of this is that the oddity and the peculiarity of my father's illness was that it affected his language very acutely. But it did so in a particular way, and it had effect on his nouns and his ability to name particular objects. His grammar and syntax remained almost untouched, but the nouns that he chose to, the nouns that became adopted were very unusual. And to his great relief and ours in a way, some of them were deeply amusing. I mean, he used to talk about going up the hill for the three easy ones, which I think was milk, egg, and bread. He'd talk about the orange nose bag, which was the parking disc. When he turned on his computer, he would talk about manufacturing the sky, which was rather poignant and beautiful. And the word for poetry, that's right, if he was ever talking about poetry, the word for poetry was cake. And it would always stay cake. And if he meant cake, if he said cake, I knew he meant poetry. Here was a situation that someone that was deeply frustrated with the loss of grip on language. And I went from that to the Oxford University Press, which has only just recently, I suppose about 8 or 10 years previously, closed down its own printing press. It used to run on the top floor above where the editors were. But the people that worked there previously were still very much there. So the language of typography and typesetting was absolutely alive. And this incredible diction, those of you that have been involved with printing will be aware of, it's a whole language in itself, was very much alive. And made a very strong impression upon me, the sort of and the utter malleability of language. That here were people so skilled and controlled of the physical units of type, because only until some years before, hot metal had been set at the Oxford University Press, and there's still a museum there where you can see the hot metal and so on. And the contrast between the two situations of total control over the units of language at the press and the lack of it at home bore this poem. So this is a poem really about typography and printers. It's got lots of printers' terms in it, which I won't gloss. It's also got at least one terrible printer's joke in it. Printers are not renowned for their sense of humor, though they believe they are. So there is a bad printing joke in this. And other than that, I think I only need to say that the poem begins in the printer's press and then kind of comes home at the end. And it takes its title, the title of the poem is called The Stone Man. And the stone man was the very last person in the chain of typesetting, so that after you'd set out your forms and you set the type back to front and you had your pages of 8 or pages of 16, you give it to the stone man, and that was the very last moment in the procedure before it went off to the printing press. I'll just read this one poem. The Stone Man. One. A true navigator. He could course the old print works from memory, decoding a world of pikers and rubies, of going to the case for Brevier, Bejoyce, lining the back to front type, sort by sort, or leading the galley for the optimum gauge before taking the chase to the stone man, who'd dress it with furniture, side sticks, coins, measuring the gutters, locking the form for press. A world of infinite detail. He learned to tell founts by the slightest flourish, the kern of an F, the spur on a G, those stubby descenders of Gaudi, those Baskerville J's, Fournier Z's, and the crazed swash of Gazlon and Garamond. He would scour the cases for dog's cocks, ampersands, the old face of Blado Polyphilus, drumming up scraps on the origins of out of sorts, or how we take upper and lower case at the height at which the type was stored. To handle the language like that, to lift, assured, each letter into place, knowing it either clean or dissed, one or the other, no in between, and throwing the frocked type for the recast when the paraffin no longer did the trick. And yet, more than aware of composing a line that soon would be lifted and distributed, so that nothing he worked would survive him, only its residue, imposed in print out of it. In the same way, his men are scattered now, far flung or melted down, leaving only the legacy of how, as a young devil, some wag would send him for sky hooks, striped ink, an italic space, or the old long wait. And after all, what did the zero say to the eight? But I like your belt. Two. The thing, you know, that goes with the mongoose, no mouse, no, again. The thing, this, triangular shaped with hands. And the thing, this, rectangular shaped with hands. And I want some. Okay. Far from okay. It's November, and you've talked this way since March. Raffling for nouns, what my compositor would call a pie, all out of sorts, your galley of the swapped around. Thank God. How it makes you smile to hear yourself say that you fed the briefcase or the mantelpiece, and in its way, how eloquent that booting your laptop manufactures the sky. But you're tongue-tied, belted, deported from language, where there are almost no zooms or orange nose bags, going to the place of the three easy ones, the head grind tea, or some such else. And 5 miles out of surgery, your head still newly sewn, you ask, when will the stone cutter come to cut the stone? Let me set this line the way you want it, and lay the letters you would choose. No damaged characters or battered type. no sort in need of planing, no widows and orphans, but the right fount, sheer measure, aligned, and no omissions. All we want is to draw a little proof from the world, from time to time, catch sight of ourselves in the printer's mirror, and say, we set it right, before moving on to the stone man, to leave his indelible mark, so that long after the inking and the distributing of sorts, what is left is binding, an impression, and paper.
Salvage. Dawn floods through the valley from the east. A feral rose that has grown up through the thornbush is caught in its currents. A single bloom transformed, become its own lantern hung above the garden. Radiant, elect, its ventricles and channels charged with light, its scarlet bell streaming, as if it were Christ's sacred heart, radiating flames, spilling at the brim with the jewel-bright pulse of morning, already beginning to break apart with the love of the world beyond limit or bearing.
Things I have loved. The flea, principally, pronounced flay. Smart, who disliked clean linen, whom Johnson would as lief pray with as anyone. Paper aeroplanes, like prayers in childhood, winged, rising, risen. Head flare in multi-directional light. That black down morning, the lamb was born, dead, beside his sister. 26th of March, the jute sack and the shovel, as if by magic. My never-to-be-born daughter of the house of Miro Caseda. How her body bucked like a beast dragged by its neck from the halt when I touched it as instructed. Each breath, a mist or brief wrapped element, swept up, escaped. Fenlight, shivering in its seat.
As part of the commission that I mentioned earlier for the British Film Institute, one of the other films that I came across was a film about mining, but it mentioned in passing about the man that had invented the horse jacuzzi, and I had no idea there was such a thing as a horse jacuzzi, and I found this very interesting and thought it could lend itself to some comedy. But when I started writing the poem, it turned out to be a tragedy. And this is me kind of imagining a horse in a jacuzzi thinking of death, or wondering whether a horse thinks of death when it's in a jacuzzi. The horse jacuzzi hums in the corner, the only sound on a quiet night. Water is pumped, stable smells, the foamy purple tide. Gush after gush trails her body curves, and like a girdle or the most tender love, clips her solid waist. She chafes and slams, rubbing her legs, shanks, thighs, flings her arrogant lovelock back with a petulant toss, her velvet helmet high. Great, big, mountainous sports girl, do you know that the stucco is peeling? Do you know that the heart will stop? Steam's escaping. Observe a freeze frame trickle of water, the distinct eyelashes, the the incessant weeping of drains. Thank you.
This is a poem called Toad. I thought it was appropriate to read a toad poem in Hull. It's not the same toad, it's a very different toad. It's about a friend who no longer speaks to me anymore. Toad. Toad, I have told you already, this is not your house. Why do you insist on staying there under the sink? You cannot eat the soap like that. It makes your insides sick. I remember, Toad, the shed we used to sit in, how in the fizzing light of a 20-watt bulb you were moved to unbutton love, to turn out your pockets and inspect the lint and sand in the oil palm of your toad hand. You were friendly in the sawdust then, your toad face wide as the brim of your hat. You cannot eat the soap like that. Toad, it makes my inside sick.
Okay, what we thought we'd do now is have a mixture of conversation among ourselves. Sorry, I should speak into the microphone. But also really encourage conversation from the floor, really. If there are questions that you have been bursting to ask the poets, it'd be very nice if you could contribute. But just to give you just an extra moment or two just to think about what that question might be, I just thought I'd ask one of the poets here, because what we haven't really talked about is the mentorship process, which is something that's really quite integral to the programme. And Jack, I seem to be looking at you. Would you be willing just to say a little bit about what that entails and how that's going and who you're working with?
I've been working with Joe Shapcott, who's a wonderful poet and somebody I've always admired when, you know, at my entry point into poetry. So it's been a real privilege to work with her, and it hasn't just been sort of editorial stuff. I have been sending her poems, and we've discussed them and in detail. But it's been more a sort of general conversation about where I feel I'm at and what a poem does and what it is, and in particular my kind of reticence about the term surrealist, which I sort of. Surrealism's obviously sort of locked in its historical context as a movement, but the idea of the surreal is, I feel uncomfortable aligning myself with that because it feels like there's an association with Monty Python dripping clocks and sort of a decadent, frivolous thing rather than the sort of vigorous, playful, imaginative inquiry that being playful kind of results in. So talking through her with that has been a really interesting process and sort of confronting those ideas head on with somebody so well-versed and nuts in her own way as well. So, yeah.
Thank you. And Heather, you've also started your mentorship process. Toby and Fiona are just about to begin theirs, but are you able to say a little bit about how yours is going?
I'm really enjoying my mentorship as well, like Jack. I've been working with Mark Ford, and I was interested in working with Mark because I was both interested in his poetry, but also interested in the work that he'd done on the New York poets, and he'd done a lot of editing of their work, and I'm particularly interested in them as well, so I thought he would be a minefield of relevant information, which he has indeed proven to be. And I've met him several times, and every time we've met, he's been incredibly generous with his time. And we've looked at my poems and then discussed them. And he's kind of, you know, asked me about what I'm doing and kind of challenged my approach and encouraged different things. But he's also pointed me in the direction of many, many other texts that I could look at that might take me in slightly different directions. And it kind of, you know, spends a lot of time jumping up and down and walking over to his bookshelf and pulling things off, and kind of has a reference for every possible subject that we seem to talk about. So it's been wonderful.
And Toby and Fiona, briefly, you haven't started yet, but could you just say who you're working with and what the next thing will be?
Yeah, I'm working with David Harsent, who's a poet I really like. My own work is completely different from David's, and I think that's quite good, because what you really want is somebody who's going to look at your work from the outside. And I think a kind of important element of mentoring is that it's not necessarily just focused on like technical aspects of the poetry, but you also are able to kind of like construct a relationship with your mentor where you can discuss a whole range of things. So I kind of am hoping David will kind of take on a sort of paternal role to some degree. And we can talk about, you know, a whole host of things outside the poems, which may then feed into them later.
I'm going to be working with Alice Oswald, who I'm really excited to do that. I think she's a really exciting writer, and I'm really interested in what she's doing with language. And yeah.
And David, I was about to call you a veteran now, but that would be unfortunate. But you're three books in, three collections in, and was when you were starting out, was there anything like a mentorship program? I mean, did you look towards your chosen poet, or is this something you see more and more of nowadays?
Well, when I began as a student, there was no institutionalised creative writing, but in Trinity College in Dublin, there was a writer in residence, and during one period in my very protracted life as a graduate student, Michael Longley was the writer in residence, and he took the job very more seriously maybe than he needed to. And he identified some writers on campus, he brought them together. And I never formally joined his workshop, but he did persuade me to come along occasionally. And that was a very useful experience, I must say. Kind of life-alteringly so. He was very good to me. And I think he got a sense of excitement out of this, of being around younger writers, and I certainly got a lot out of that too. So there's an element of surprise. You've got to learn new things, things about yourself and the other person, and I'm very grateful to him for that.
That's interesting, David, because my route in was almost identical. I was at Edinburgh University, and there was a writer in residence there called Andrew Gregg. And those days, no one knew what a writer in residence was, or certainly what they looked like. And it turned out they kind of wore leather jackets and hung around in the canteen smoking roll-ups, and they put little handwritten signs up saying, writer in residence, fifth floor, or David Hume Tower. And you go and see them with your poems in a very timorous fashion and hand them over. But it was the most extraordinary moment for me, because it was the first time, apart from two or three closest friends, I'd shown any work to anybody of any kind. But it made such a difference, because someone was able to give you kind of confidence and encourage you to get underway. But as you say, now that's, in a way, that's been more institutionalised. And
well, I presume if he or a younger version of Michael Longley was the writer in residence now, everything would be totally mapped out for him. He'd have all these workshops lined up. But I think that maybe it was a more innocent age. He was just given a room and told, well, do whatever you want, so he could invent the job on his own terms.
And David, you've also edited selected poems of Samuel Beckett, which is just coming out at the beginning of next month with Fabers. Beckett, did he have anything of a relationship with anybody in this mentorship capacity?
Did he? Well, he gave B.S. Johnson enough money to buy a sports car. I mean, does that count as mentorship?
I think so.
He was friendly, as we all know, with younger writers. I was at a conference in Reading recently where somebody was presenting a trove of letters of Beckett's about the French or Swiss writer Robert Paget, and they were very moving letters about how highly he did indeed think of this man, recommending him for prizes and things. Obviously, he wasn't doing this in a writer-in-residence kind of situation. But no, even somebody as proverbially aloof from the whole business as Beckett did make it his business to sponsor younger writers. Certainly, yeah. He also did that with people like Aidan Higgins and who else? Other people that I can't remember now.
Thank you. Could I see if there are any questions on the floor to any of the poets, either about the tour or what they get up to, or the process of working towards a collection, or thoughts about working with poets in particular? It's always a risk, isn't it? But I'll give you an extra moment. Toby, you've been... We were sort of joking about the process of you being based up in Gateshead, and we started off in the south and we're coming back this direction. And you're saying, oh no, we've just started on the road and you're already taking me home. But this experience of being on tour, people sometimes assume that poetry is a kind of a sort of celibate life somehow, that you don't.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. But and you do not commune in any sense, and you don't have anything like a community. But is that your experience? I mean, is the thing that's happening this week freakishly strange, or is it your experience of what the poetry world is actually like?
Well, no, I've been celibate for many years in terms of poetry, certainly up until a couple of years ago. You know, I'd between the ages of about 21 and 29, I just sat and wrote because that's what I wanted to do. And it wasn't really until I got to know the poet Gillian Allnut, and she kind of took me under her wing to some degree, very kindly. But I've since then, and certainly since we've been on tour, all the poets we've worked with have just been immensely kind and immensely giving of their time. You know, last night we were reading with Bernard O'Donoghue, a couple of nights before George Surtees, and these are kind of like formidable figures in the world of poetry, but they've just been so kind and so encouraging and so thoughtful in the things that they say. That, you know, I think poets generally extremely approachable. They're keen for you to do well. They're keen to see new work. So I've started to feel that I am kind of like part of a kind of wider community. But I think at the same time, it's possibly a good idea sometimes to keep that at arm's length and know when you've just got to be on your own and work. But to know that there are those people around is important, you know. Yeah, I think so.
If you do have a question, just pop your arm up. Thank you very much.
Actually, it makes you feel really good. When you see the pamphlets, they're such beautiful things, and to see like your name in like the Faber type, it's like the kind of thing you used to dream about, you know. So I personally haven't really felt intimidated at all. I've just felt incredibly encouraged that, you know, somebody likes your work and is prepared to do this. And I think that encouragement, that sense of confidence that it gives you, I think is really important. So it's been entirely good as far as I'm concerned.
I would just echo that, really. My first thought was, I've got the same cover as Wallace Stevens, you know, and that was it for me. Going around on the bus has been, you know, we've been incredibly well supported and very well received everywhere we've been, so it's been great. And I can see how it might seem that it would be intimidating, but it actually hasn't been, because everybody's been so generous and kind to us, as Toby says.
I think if there's anything that's intimidating about it, it's being aware of the sort of lineage that's stacked up behind you. You feel a bit like you're at the front of a decelerating train and you've got all this stuff, these carriages sort of piling up behind you, all the weight of that, of history and prestige. But actually, I think if you don't have that anyway, then you're probably not writing poems in a way. I think that's a huge generalization, but I think there's an awareness of being part of a tradition anyway, which is about making. And so I think that kind of anxiety is just, is a healthy one. And I think it's something that's probably always been there for all of us, if, you know, having read poems before we tried to write them.
I agree. I was kind of paralysed with fear to begin with. I thought every poem I wrote was, I was kind of writing them all off. Like, that's not good enough for what we're doing. But everybody's been so kind, and Matthew's kind of being incredible. He's driving us around and looking after us. And
well, there's also the hearing of the 80th birthday celebrations, the idea of the green room there rifling through our new poet, pamphlets was quite a sort of, seemed absurd. I mean, I've just begun to get over the idea of somebody actually reading a poem in a house that isn't mine, that I haven't showed them, you know, that somebody somewhere else might be reading one of my poems is a kind of strange idea, that there is a reader. To hear that reader might be Heaney or Muldoon, it's just sort of, you know, it wilts you a bit.
And I suppose that the other side of that is the fact that these things are now in public, and anyone can read them, and anyone can say what they like about them in print as well. Mm. And that process is just beginning, which is a weird and wonderful process, we hope, certainly. But David, do you remember the first time when your work was coming through and you had to face the sort of daunting prospect of reviews and that kind of thing? And what did that feel like?
Well, that also dates me now because I have published three books, and I would say just on a kind of sociological note, my first book got more reviews than the second, which got more reviews than the third. So despite the reference earlier to all the reviews of these pamphlets having come out, I would say that I'm aware of a culture in which books just don't get reviewed anymore, in which newspapers will see and then seize an opportunity to remove poetry coverage from their pages. And it will feel afterwards as if it's just never been there, it's as if it's been wiped from the record. So while there are still some public outlets which will give poetry the time of day, it's probably a mistake to assume that they will always be around, and we should cherish the ones that still are.
Indeed, it's sometimes said that actually it's a good time to be a new poet, but actually it's a tougher time to be a poet with a second or a third or a fourth book, partly because, as you say, there's less interest in the media and there's less coverage in the media.
Well, I can easily imagine somebody getting a contract to bring out a book of new poets tomorrow, but a book of like poets in their third collections or past poets. You know, you get your moment, and then your moment passes, and you might feel that that is much harder, in fact, because you know you've had your chance. So, you know, what can you do that's new?
I'd like to ask whether the new poets share this notion that in your 20s, you really shouldn't, if you're a novelist, you might get your novel out and people are pretty promoting to become novelists. But here, you're entering this process of having to consider yourself and starting out and being mentored. You're actually really yearning. If you've got this collection, you would like people to notice, and but you're also having to pay along with being the new ones that are still building up your talents. What's your own sense of being a
sort of a current situation? Or?
Do you agree that you've got to really wait to be there, it's still ready to get this first collection out, it takes 16 years?
I don't think you can put any sort of age limit. I think it's just entirely to do with when you feel like you have the material ready. It's nice to know that the material that we all do have ready has a home now, and we can put that to bed, and that sort of takes some of the pressure off of putting the first book out. You can feel a bit like a hobbyist. You know, it can feel a bit cozy if you just write poems and they're not going anywhere, and it can be frustrating. And particularly when it takes so long for magazines to get back, you know, you can wait 6 months to get your rejection letter and file it away with the others. So something like this is a kind of like a stable home. And in terms of that position, it just makes you want to kind of get busy writing the next stuff, really. I don't know if that's what everyone else feels.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that to a degree, but I think it's a mistake to assume that the aim of a poet is to like get their first collection out or even get a book out. You know, I see my aim as to just write better poems, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. You know, if it wouldn't matter to me personally, if people, it's very, very nice to be published and to be associated with this, but at the end of the day, it's not going to stop me writing poems. Because that's just what you do, you know, whether you're published, whether you're not published, you just keep working on them. So, yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to have, and it's a wonderful opportunity, but, you know, publishing is, poetry is the aim of poetry, and not necessarily publishing it, I think.
It helps, though, doesn't it?
It does help a lot, yeah.
I suspect that we're probably coming towards the end, but we would like to finish with poems. So what I might just do is ask if the four poets with the pamphlets here this evening wouldn't mind just finishing with a short poem from those pamphlets, beginning with Fiona.
Emmaus. And if you should forget, walk out across the Hungerford Bridge, where the city falls back and pylons loom in the dark like an avenue of silver birch. Regard the work, a simple stitch, it heals the breach of the river, allows passage and pause to acknowledge our place beneath this infinite sky, in a wind that knows we are mortal, porous, a beautiful trick of the light.
I wrote this poem for my son. It's called Poem 3 Weeks After Conception. The sky will be shaped like a bow when you crane your neck to pray into it. Roofless, but not burned, though black, spangled. Your hair will be the white spray at high force, teeth pebbles in the vent. You will escape the ogre of psoriasis that lives on the knees, elbow caps, genitals, and face. For you, the stars have already locked into place. For you, the blue coltsfoot in the allotment will be an electrical wonder. The red kite, wolf, and bear will return to the borders in numbers. You will be buried in a country far away, a country like home, of absolute rainfall, beneath a late moon unfurling. You shall witness the domination of Jerusalem, the capsize of London. I pray that I will never hit or humiliate you, for whom the best wine in the world will be pressed in Kent. Who will live to see supermarkets dictating military policy to governments? Our Lady of Gateshead, watch over us.
I'm going to end with a poem that perhaps in some way answers your question a little bit, or maybe gestures towards it. And it's kind of, it references both being up to my neck in art and never knowing that whether it might stop at any moment. Le Parc. Every fifth Tuesday of the month, my grandfather would meet with Monsieur de Champ in Le Jardin Public. Et voilà, Marcel digressed by the weeping beech tree. The hanging branches touched the ground. Being an artist, he said in squeezed English as he probed the foliage, is like crawling on your hands and knees along a narrow tunnel just to wash your filthy hands in the sink at the end of it, and then spending the rest of your life trying to get out, backwards. A nut in a husk hit the soil. At any time, though, my grandfather observed, one might be hauled out by one's ankles.
Certain. Nothing before had seemed so potent and self-contained. Surely the onion was beautiful. Its hung cloud of acid worked in his nose and throat as the knife bisected like a maker of names, passing between twins, calling one half perfect, the other also perfect.
Just like a quick thank you very much to Martin and everyone that brought us here, and also very much to you for coming and contributing and being part of it. I'm very grateful for David Wheatley for joining us on the platform, whose selected poems of Samuel Beckett is published next month. And otherwise, I'm very grateful, and could I ask you just one more time, please, just to thank Fiona Benson, Toby Martinez de Las Rivas, Heather Phillipson, and Jack Underwood. Thank you very much for coming.
I might wear your hands out again in a moment. Just like to say that here at a university, when sort of part of our aim is to take people of any age and help really shift them up into the next stage of their writing lives, it's exciting to get this opportunity to have four people that have been sort of burrowing away and achieving to bring out these first collections. And I admire the support that, you know, the Arts Council and Faber are giving to sort of bring these out in the world. It's been exciting to get this sort of these new fresh voices coming and talking to us. So that's brilliant. And thank you, Matthew, as well. It's been wonderful to hear your works. I'm going to just do one slight plug, one in my pocket here, for it's a series of readings that are happening here. These are leaflets that are going out. It's not readings, in fact, it's workshops by Francis Levison, who's around somewhere. Can we just sort of wave a hand? Who's giving this sort of spectacularly generous sort of series of workshops in Hull for poets to sort of come and become sort of more engaged and wondrous poets. So that's happening. Those leaflets are on the back, and also leaflets for our own events. November the 4th, Phyllida Delaw, talking about her, with her own memoir and note forms about her deaf mother-in-law, coming up November the 4th. But thanks to you for coming up. You're making it sort of happen for us. You're making it real. And thanks again to sort of Matthew and all the poets. Thank you very much.